and welcome to our weekly live stream recording of the M&A Zing, a podcast series devoted to acquisition entrepreneurs, search funds and holdco builders in the UK and EU, discussing the topics and challenges that impact SMB succession M&A. We're also exploring the highs and lows of searching, acquiring, owning and operating small and medium-sized businesses. And we are here this week with another ever-popular buy-side breakdown. But before we get into that, we've had a very busy week, haven't we, Gareth? Last week was our inaugural Serial Acquirer Symposium.
My goodness, I'm not sure we've yet recovered. It was a lot of prep, a lot on the day, and a lot of love and post-event activity. So, yeah, and then I managed to fly out shortly afterwards, do a weekend in Dubai and get stuck. So I managed to find my way back to the UK now. But yes, it was amazing. Our symposium was just, I mean, it surpassed all of our expectations, and they were fairly high. Yeah. 230 people in attendance. We had keynotes from Piers Linney about AI implementation and post-deal value creation. We had Lizzie Arnold, who told us all about how to tackle the first 100 days from her experience helping a number of searchers. We had Ibrahim Abdulrahim from Moonbase Capital giving us the outlook for Europe and the ETA scene in the next 5 years. I mean, it was interspersed with panels and discussions and live pods and loads of stuff that has happened. So thank you, everybody that kindly contributed, sponsored, participated, attended. Really was incredible and spurred us on to do the next one, Alfie.
Absolutely, with a bit of rest. it was a really great day. There was a really excellent buzz in the venue. Everybody that I've spoken to since has told me how much they enjoyed it and how much value they got from it. And people from all different parts of the journey. I spoke to people it was their first ever event like this, fresh from an MBA, haven't done a search before, just getting into it. Also spoken to some sort of seasoned M&A pros who have been doing this for a decade plus and still felt like they learned something from the day. So that was particularly special. And there was a real sort of feeling of excitement. The final sort of networking when we had the last couple of drinks, everybody I spoke to left there with a newfound enthusiasm for ETA. And that was really what it was all about.
Yeah, it's an amazing community. It really is collaborative, got a can-do, bias for action. It was vibrant. What can I say? It was a real honor to host them for the day, and the first of many, I'm sure. So, so back by popular demand, here we are with a buy-side breakdown. In fact, it was mentioned by a number of people in the room. Why don't you do another one of those? We like those. So here we are. Before we start releasing lots of the content from the event over the next few weeks, let's get stuck into one of these. What have we got?
Well, interestingly enough, we've got a very different type of business this time. We are looking at a creative and digital agency based in Warwickshire, listed on businessesforsale.com and listed by Knightsbridge. They're based in the West Midlands. Asking price of 3 million quid for a turnover of £814,000, undisclosed net profit. But adjusted EBITDA of about 132,000. Like I said, this is on businessesforsale.com. We'll include the link at the bottom of this episode. So if you want to go and take a look for yourself and follow along, please do.
Great. Okay. Anything specifically stand out? I'm looking at the link. I can see a couple of locations, two leasehold premises. From what I can tell from trying to decode who this is, it looks to have sites in Warwickshire and London. They mentioned specifically that they are an Umbraco partner, so that should make it relatively easy to dial in. Can't be too many of those in Warwick these days. So what do we know? We know that they're making about 100 grand out of about 800 grand. That's I mean, this is typical of an agency model, particularly of this age, I guess. There's quite an appetite at the moment amongst consolidators to pick up agencies of this sort of size, circa 1 to 2 million in revenue. This is just shy of that, but to sort of put them together, roll them up, create almost sort of multidisciplinary kind of offer. So I know we've got a number of buyers on BizCrunch that are looking specifically for digital agencies, actually, be they marketing, be they brand, be they social media, web design. These guys seem to do a few of those things. Obviously, the standout thing that keeps leaping out to me whenever I look at this space is, here we are at the sort of AI revolution. Is that a threat or an opportunity? Is that going to cannibalize this sort of business, this sort of market, or is it going to supercharge it and enable, you know, better margins, etc.? What do you think?
I think, and people ask me this question about AI all the time, I think it comes down to the operator. I think you can choose which way it goes. I think if you don't adapt and implement and include it in your strategy, then it will cannibalize the business. So I think that you need to think about smart ways to, you know, adopt it, to make it part of your process. And I'm not saying that you should replace your incredible, you know, creative output with AI based, but, you know, there are lots of things that you could do, especially for this kind of agency. You know, initial drafts and mock-ups could be AI based before passing them over to a senior designer, you know, cutting down time, efficiencies. There's so many things that could be brought in. I do think that it would potentially be a slight risk to some of the staff there, because I do think that that's partially where some of these efficiencies are going to be made. I think you do need less sort of boots on the ground to get the work done if you are going to be more efficient with AI. But I do think that would probably go some way to improving the gap between the, you know, 800K incoming to only 100K earnings.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know how they manage their, you know, what goes through the P&L, et cetera. Sure. But it does feel a little bit underwhelming at 12% EBITDA. I imagine that, you know, the agency could grow its EBITDA either through decosting some of the back office, and AI could be, you know, super helpful there, or using AI to augment the staff and increase the capacity of the business to do more. Broaden the offer, take on more clients without having to grow the overhead, and that in itself will grow the returns.
Yeah, and look, there's absolutely room for growth here. Another figure that really jumps out to me is that this company's been alive since 1988, same as me. And in that time, they've managed to grow to 100K a year in recurring revenue. That feels low to me. And obviously, I come from a SaaS background where recurring revenue is key, and it is a little tougher when it comes to agencies, but a lot of agencies have, you know, long-standing customers, and there was another point to be made here about how many of those are tied to the owner, and we can come to that later, but there's definitely room for growth there, because I mean, what are we looking at here? So 700K a year is having to be found by a sales team or incoming queries. There's a lot of legwork done there.
Sounds like it. And if that's the case, you know, if they're generating that kind of pipeline to create that sort of new business, non-recurring every year, why stop there? Why are they only delivering that number? But how much of that could be converted to recurring on, you know, contracts and frameworks, et cetera? Who knows? But it feels like a project-based business in that sense, rather than necessarily having a regular throughput.
I would say, as a positive, they obviously do have a good sales process there, because if they are bringing in 700K of new business every year, that's great. So if they could supplement that with a bit more recurring revenue, then there's definitely some money to be made.
Yeah, but I think my read is they're taking on what they're comfortable working to, what they're working with, rather than necessarily, you know, going hell for leather to grow the top line or the bottom line. And that's, you know, fairly customary of agencies of this sort of size. Mm-hmm. Some of them have got huge ambitions, but the majority are subsisting, you know, in enjoyable, intellectual kind of challenges, if you will, for the team. And that's all good. There's no right or wrong in that sense. It just does make it a little bit more difficult to sell on. Obviously, you mentioned the age of this business, and that the listing does say that it's a retirement driven sale. Mm-hmm. But I guess the elephant in the room we need to address is good old Knightsbridge. They've done a number on them here, because 100K in EBITDA has somehow translated to a 30 times earnings, 3 million asking price. Where the bejesus does that come from?
I have no idea. And this is, you know, all jokes aside, this is something that we really do need to tackle in the ETA world, because I speak to so many searchers who, you know, contact a business, you know, even if they do off market, and then that business might go away and talk to someone like a Knightsbridge, and they give them a crazy inflated asking price that obviously the search is never going to match, because that 3 million isn't realistic by any stretch of the imagination. But now, you know, retiring business owner is expecting that, you know, and is already sort of counting that check and imagining the sangria on the beach that they'll be drinking with their earn out. And when the searcher comes along and offers them, you know, a damn sight less, it's going to be a shock. And those are the kind of deals that fall apart. So, yeah. I have no idea where that figure's come from. There's going to have to be some serious movement there, I think.
Well, thankfully, someone has appended to the listing the words offers invited. So that's good. They'll take an offer on their 3 million, on their 30 times earnings. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, be disparaging, but in pursuit of listing fees, sometimes you hear of sellers being sold disproportionate multiples and being blissfully unaware of the fact that a company like this probably trades at 4 to 5 times earnings to a strategic acquirer, given it's an agency, given some recurrence. But even that is, you know, steep in what is probably a business with some concentration risk around the senior ownership.
I would think that, and I mean, I don't know if I'm going too low here, but I would probably say that a realistic starting price for this would be closer to £500,000 rather than 3.
That's where most people will probably begin, and that's probably why this will struggle to transact, because it's such a country mile away. It's opposite poles of the earth from reality versus the dream that perhaps these sellers have been sold. And I really do feel for them, because you see this time and time again. But look, who knows, without digging into the business and understanding what the potential is, which you'd hope it would have shown signs of being able to achieve over 37 years. You know, it's difficult to say what premium, what upside, what potential you could be talking about here. But I would, you know, you typically hedge your bets, right? And you're buying past performance proven, which hopefully will deliver the same performance or more going forward. But can we extrapolate it that much to say this is going to become a, you know, £5 million company in order to justify that? £5 million revenue company? No.
There's some information in the listing that says that there currently has £200,000 worth of upcoming projects quoted. I'd be interested to know what their conversion rate on that is. It also, it does feel like there's a disconnect between, they've got 200 grand's worth of pipeline, but they're somehow, you know, bringing in 700K's worth of new business every year. So is that just for a quarter's worth of quoted business? I'm not sure. You know, where is that coming from? Also, one thing that I do know about the agency model is there's going to be a lot of money tied up in invoices, I would imagine. A lot of that revenue.
Well, I think the balance sheet certainly proves that out. You can see that the assets are basically trade debtors. About 380 grand of trade debtors. So, yeah, I mean, you'd wonder about credit control. That feels like that's getting on for 50% of an annual revenue that's outstanding for payment. Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on there, but at year end, I would look for that to be as captured as possible, right? And to be pulling in the note, putting in that money. So yeah, very odd that it would have. I mean, is that normal, Alfie? Can you speak to that, whether those sort of credit cycles, which look protracted to me, is the norm in agency work?
I mean, having slightly longer cycles is fairly common in agency work, but perhaps not to this scale. I'm unsure as to what's happening there. I mean, you can uncover anything when you start to dig into this. It may be that they have long-standing relationships with some of these customers, and they have give them a little bit more leeway on their sort of payment terms. I would like to hope they have some really solid cash flow management going on there, because otherwise, it feels a bit precarious, that. Oh, Gareth, I've lost you.
I'm back. Oh. It also appears that the creditors are sort of in step with that, those debtors to some extent, because there's about 180K's worth of creditors there, out of the 380K, if you like, of debtors.
Okay.
You'd sort of think, okay, the margin, the gross margin's not unhealthy, but yeah, maybe they're just carrying that forward, waiting to get paid before they pay their creditors, which is, I guess, again, normal. And they seem to have about 30K's worth of cash on hand, according to the balance sheet, which, again, existentially, you'd wonder about that. So, not the most encouraging of financial results at the last year end to suggest that it's worth paying that sort of premium for.
No, and I think that where we're having these kind of conversations and we're pulling up some negatives, if this was more reasonably priced, I think I would feel a lot more comfortable about a lot of this. I think that we're, you know, some of these risks are being pegged against that inflated asking price. And I think that makes some of this seem maybe a little worse than it is. I think if this was priced at £500,000, I wouldn't be so nervous about some of these things. I mean, obviously, there is still some risk there. But it's what's an acceptable risk at the price, I think.
And again, you know, what's the loyalty of the customers like? What's the loyalty of the staff like? What's the USPs of the business like? I mean, you know, there are things to consider. We don't want to just go all in on you know, one year end of numbers. But from what I can tell, their website, if it is the business that we think it is, you know, they're doing app development, they're doing print work, video, social media and SEO, you know, general marketing, experiential exhibition marketing. So it's quite a broad church. It's quite a you know, multidisciplinary agency, which actually I think is quite exciting. But what kind of deal structure do you end up doing here? You know, there's got to be a hell of a lot of contingent deal. You know, I think I keep, whenever I look at marketing agencies, I, you know, tip my hat to the Martin Sorrell approach of WPP, where there was a lot of contingent, you know, in the deal structure, where, you know, he was acquiring 100% of shares, but the sellers didn't get much of their money out unless they continue to grow the company. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, to an extent genius from a hedging of downside risk, but also from a capital efficiency perspective, he did some great deals. What we would have to look at here, if particularly if you're going to pay a premium for it, is, you know, very little upfront by comparison, but liberating the owners to step away from the business but still enjoy the fruits of the cash flow, if you will, by way of dividends, for the, you know, X number of years that you agree on the deferred contingent consideration or earnout. Mm-hmm. So do you see this being an all cash deal?
No, very likely not. And look, you know, if we go back to the fact that there seems to be a single owner that's retiring and the age of the business, another reason that I would want to keep them on hand for as long as possible and make some of this contingent is how much owner dependency is there, because it's likely that after such a long tenure that the owner is probably a sort of key figure in these client relationships. And as we know, you know, retirement can pose a bit of a key person risk. You know, how many of those recurring revenue clients are tied to that owner? I mean, obviously we don't know, but I'd imagine quite a few after 37 years. And moreover, you know, what's that client concentration? Because I've, you know, worked with agencies over a lot of time, and they said they have sort of circa 58 clients. But, you know, if one of those is 20, 25% of their revenue or more, that's also a pretty big risk. And these will be things that I would factor into, you know, earnout, contingency, how long I want to keep the owner around for.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah,
I would do the same. And you know, you would do your standard due diligence here of requesting sort of an anonymized list of the top 20 customers. And if they can't come up with 20 customers, then you've got a problem. But if one of them accounts for sort of, you know, 25-30% of the business, you do have quite a risk on your hands. Mm-hmm. I know that if it is the business we think it is, it's a husband and wife ownership, you know, two PSCs, okay, two owners. Both 60 odd years old. So I can see someone picking this up, taking it forward, utilizing AI, digitally transforming the business. Mm-hmm. I do see this having some potential, but I think the question is whether a deal gets done, because it appears to sail quite close to the wind, and the expectation for consideration, like the valuation, is so high by comparison to what maybe someone would actually pay to take this on.
I agree. This isn't going to be a business that is going to make you a very rich person, I don't think. I think that if you were beginning a serial acquisition process that was going to roll up a number of agencies, or you'd already begun that process, I think it could be a useful addition. That's probably where I would see the, not at the 3 million valuation, but that's probably where I would see this fitting. So you know, if you already offer some of these services and there is some consolidation that you can do, you know, they have inroads into their local market and some in London, and perhaps you're in another part of the country and you want to bring some of these businesses together, I think that's probably where I would see this fitting best. Another thing that I would raise, though, this is another risk, and I'm sorry to keep bringing up negatives here. There's a bit of a technology focus risk, because they have a technical niche in Umbraco, which, for those that don't know, is a specific CMS, think WordPress, but a slightly less popular version. And it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because it sets them apart in the fact that not all agencies, in fact, very few agencies do the Umbraco projects. I don't come across them very often. But it does also mean they rely on that ecosystem staying relevant. So obviously WordPress is the dominant force for SME websites. Umbraco has been around since the early 2000s. I haven't used it in a very long time, and I don't see it very often. But obviously a lot of these CMS and website building companies, to bring it back to AI, are being kind of pushed out by AI. And you think about, you know, even your Lovables and what have you. And I would like to know what percentage of their revenue comes from these specific Umbraco projects, because I would see that as a potential risk going forward.
Yeah, what you mean, a concentration risk into a particular provider or technology sector or whatever. Yeah.
And like I said, it's a double-edged sword. That it may be that they're doing particularly well from it, because not many other people do that. But yeah, like I said, you know, how long do they survive having a dependency on another platform that is in an area that's ripe for disruption is a risk.
Yeah, I think we should turn our attention to some of the positives, though, because I'm clicking through their sort of portfolio of work, and it's pretty impressive stuff, to be honest. Actually, they've got some nice marquee clients in, you know, law firms, top tier sports clubs, various co-workings, digital equipment firms. I would say there's a lot of merit in the client base, depending on how much of this is sort of continuous recurrent you know, work that they get. But also looking at the team really looks to have, you know, quite a lot of, I guess, youth, dynamism, talent within, you know, within the roster. So I feel there's like merit and potential to this firm, definitely. It's just a question of finding the right home for it, really. It's got a strong foundation.
I totally agree. Lots of really great clients. And if it is the company that we think it is, and I'm fairly sure that it is, the work that they produce is super impressive. And it may be the case that if they are producing work of this caliber for clients of this caliber, they might be slightly undercharging for the revenue that they're bringing in. I would expect projects like this for these kinds of companies to be worth a bit more. So maybe there is room for someone to come in there and make some efficiency changes and up the prices a bit, and maybe there's some more margin to be made there. Because there's some really, really great high-level work, prestige clients, and a great portfolio for anyone that does take this on and, you know, wants to go on and win new clients. So I'd be quite happy working with a company like this for my creative and digital work.
Yeah, likewise. I think there's definitely something merit in here. So I guess, who buys it? Does it have to be a roll-up? Could it be an acquisition entrepreneur? Could it be somebody? I mean, we speak to a number of them that are looking at this space. Do you see a deal getting done by, you know, an MBA or a career changer at this level?
It's difficult because at the size that it is, I would say that it might be a great sort of first deal. Don't go in over your head. Don't buy something too large and expensive. Learn the ropes and then perhaps, you know, go for another acquisition down the line. However, I would say that it's probably maybe a little bit difficult to hit the ground running with something like this unless you have a lot of experience. I think if you've got deep industry experience and you've run an agency before, it could be a great first acquisition. I think if this is your bread and butter and you know creative and digital super well, that maybe this is a great place to start. Obviously, you need to do some work on that valuation, but if they could come down to a reasonable price, I think it's got a lot going for it.
So someone that's been in a commercial or design role within an agency, but now wants to run their own show, own their own outfit. Yeah, I see that definitely being an angle here. But you'd caution against coming at this if you weren't experienced in running an agency, doing marketing, digital, you know, projects.
I would say so. I would, you know, I would think that if the people that run this company obviously know very much what they're doing, and this is where they've managed to take it in 37 years, I'd be surprised if somebody with very little industry knowledge could come in and improve it vastly in a short space of time. That's would be my thoughts. I think someone who is, yeah, dynamic, that's been working in this environment for a while, that knows what they're doing, and like you said, wants to run their own show. I mean, it could be a great candidate for a management buyout. You know, maybe there's someone on their team that could be the right person to do that and wants to take it over themselves. I think that somebody like that, I think, could do very well with this.
Yeah, you wonder whether maybe even an employee ownership trust is a way of getting this away for the owners. Like, you know, if you've got some faithful, loyal staff here that have got the ambition to, you know, to own some equity, well, actually, EOT could be the route. Obviously, you have to have a high percentage of your staff that back that idea. Mm-hmm. But the tax efficiency of an EOT is definitely worth considering because, you know, the owners could depart. It has to be a, you know, significant majority disposal, so they're not really able to retain much in the way of rollover equity. But, you know, everything they get in terms of continued payout from the business over a course of a few years is I think basically tax free.
So, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's a nice thing to do. Bit of cost and complexity to set them up, and there is a question over how onward sellable they are. You know, after the seller has been paid off.
Sure.
You know, if the EOT wants to exit, that's a little more cumbersome. That's not as well trodden yet. Not impossible. But yeah, so you wonder if maybe MBO, EOT is a route here. But yeah, I think it looks on the face of it like a nice company that has got some potential, that if it embraced the sort of technology revolution that's coming around the corner, would have a sort of window of time to really capitalize. So thumbs up or thumbs down?
It's a difficult one for me. I think with a better valuation expectation, I would give it a thumbs up. I think at the 3 million, it's a thumbs down. I think if we were looking closer to 500,000, it'd be a thumbs up. So I'm sorry, I know that's not a definitive answer. But if we're going to say as the listing is today, it's a thumbs down for me.
Yeah. I always think it's worth a negotiation. To see what the compelling, you know, proposition really could be. I would worry about concentration risk in terms of the customer acquisition and customer relationship management. Mm-hmm. If that's going out the door with the sellers, then what are you buying? But it looks like they've got an account director, and so they've sort of taken some of that, I guess, off of the owner. So I think it's worth a conversation. It looks like a nice business. The quality of work, the quality of team looks strong. It's not worth 3 million. And it kind of lives or dies, the deal, I mean, on whether a common ground accommodation could be found under 1 million for a business like this. So, you know, it might at best go for approaching 1x revenue. But with a long tail on an earnout, I think to make this affordable to to take over. It's going to be difficult to raise debt on a business like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, for anyone listening, Gareth, if you are, you know, that business owner in that position, do you think that there is more that they could do to push brokers to give them a more reasonable valuation? I know that they obviously want the best price that they can, but is there more that, you know, business owners could be doing to do the bit of their own research and not come to market way overpriced and put buyers off?
There is an increasing amount of data available to sellers if they look. DealSuite did a great job. DealSuite did a fantastic job of releasing a report which had some useful information around multiples in different geographies and different verticals.
Right.
And I recommend that to any sellers reading, so they know what, you know, typically companies are changing hands for. Spoilers, it's not 30 times earnings. I think, you know, information is key. Knowledge is power. I think, unfortunately, a number of sellers believe everything they're told and are lambs to the slaughter in that sense, from which I mean the deals don't get done because they're so far apart. You know, it's sort of doomed from the outset because the expectations are inflated and everything is just going to be naturally disappointing. Mm-hmm. So it's, I think, single-handedly responsible for so many businesses just going, I might as well wrap it up then because I'm not going to get what I was promised for it.
How much money have I spent on listing fees over the last year and nothing's come to fruition? You know, they're not cheap.
Well, I heard of one the other day that had been paying 5 years worth of annual listing fees.
And I've heard of listing fees up to sort of 10K a month.
I mean, not with this.
Not for this size of business, no. But yeah. Still, that, you know, it adds up over a year.
It certainly does. Mm. So I think, only come to market when you're ready and you're convinced you're going to be able to sell. Sensible expectations, do your homework, look at what businesses like yours are changing hands for. Mm. Make sure you're working with a representative, an intermediary that's actually going to run a proactive process for you. That's going to bring you, ultimately, deals succeed in favor of the seller with the highest possible kind of market valuation if there's a competitive process run. Mm-hmm. So if you've got multiple people knocking on the door and are on a time constrained process, you know, full and final sealed bids by this day, that momentum optimizes your exit value. Okay. As a seller. What we've got is a lot of set and forget kind of going on in the market where, thanks for your fees, we'll stick it on a listing website, we'll see what the market says. Mm-hmm. That doesn't get anybody anywhere and it just leads to disappointment. And erosion of value.
Yeah, I think also it's, you know, it's a great shout for sellers, for business owners to look at, you know, exit readiness practitioners and courses and any of those things. I think that sometimes they might rather not add another intermediary and they feel like they're going to lose some, you know, there's going to be some cost associated to that. But I think that's a false economy. I think the money and the time that you would spend getting properly exit ready would make a huge difference, not only to your valuation, but you would be more prepared for, you know, a better, a more realistic valuation at the end. You know, all your ducks are in a row. And when the right searcher comes along, you've got everything prepped and ready and the due diligence is easier. And I definitely advocate for that.
100%. Yeah. Exit readiness is the key to getting a deal done, taking advantage of that momentum, ensuring that you're not going to, you know, fall over during the due diligence. And yes, if you can do exit readiness and then have a good advocate that's bringing a number of people to the table, you might get something approaching the exit value that you're looking for. Mm. So, yeah. Anyway, in this case, this business looks like it will find a home with somebody, if not the staff, at some point in the future. And I wish them well. I think, you know, there's a future here. I hope it goes into good ownership.
I do too, because they do great work and it would be a shame to lose that. Excellent. Okay, so we are, I don't know, are we going to give a definitive answer? Is this a thumb? It's a sort of thumbs in the middle, I guess.
I'll go with the thumbs in the middle.
The middle this week. Okay. Well, I'm sorry to any listeners who wanted a definitive answer, but please do, leave your comments below the video and on LinkedIn and let us know what you think. And you know, where you think maybe this should be valued at, and what you'd be happy to pay for it. In the meantime, I have a little bit of BizCrunch news to share. So obviously I like to talk BizCrunch product wherever I can. We've got some exciting new features on the way, including the BizCrunch virtual data room, which I've been sneak peek trialing, showing certain demo users recently. So if anybody's interested in that, please let me know. There'll be obviously a big sort of launch and fanfare around that, but I just thought I'd tease that to our listeners, which is very exciting stuff. And it's all part of our drive to become the operating system for SMB M&A. So we're currently find, outreach, and track. It will soon be due diligence and beyond. So I'm very excited about that. And if you are looking for that service, come and talk to me, and I'm happy to give you a sort of peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, well said, Alfie. I mean, everything we're doing is trying to catalyze more deals, you know, more succession of SMBs going into new ownership, to go into their new era of growth. That's important for Western economies. It's important for, you know, the staff of those businesses, the reward for those ambitious founders and acquirers. You know, if we can get deals done in greater number, more efficiently, then, you know, more power to everybody. So yeah, exciting that we're just gradually ticking off things on our roadmap in order to achieve that objective.
Absolutely. Well, that's all from us this week. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Please leave your comments on whether you're a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or a tentative thumbs in
thumbs
the middle.
Middle thumbs, then, not middle fingers, folks.
And until then, as ever, keep on crunching.